The poet John Ashbery writes of the poetry collection No Planets Strike, the landscapes in Josh Bell's daft American heartland are as dangerous, funny, and drop-dead gorgeous as those in a Roadrunner cartoon. Roadrunner is a good place to start, for Josh's playful lines can roar past or pull up unexpectedly. They run with a crazed, cartoony dream logic, bending back on themselves or on us, sometimes flat and glib, sometimes dense and lyrical, often surreal and inventive, but also frequently tinged with the sadness of a restless young man with a big, hurting bosom. What I love most about Josh Bell's poems are the inventive motifs, whether it's a bogus poem about the book's typeface, or lines like this from a poem called Poem to Line My Casket With, Ramona, addressed to one of the book's recurring characters. You used to skip church. You used to skip dinner parties. Now you've been seen hoisting condoms from the pharmacy. There are 12 condoms to a pack. A pack of lovers mills outside your door. A pack of the dead are heading toward the showers. A pack of dead lovers is referred to as, quote, a creep of lovers. More than one dead lover is weeping, but oh, how it was me who loved you then. When I first died, I stole a lock of your hair while you slept. Now I dip in ink when the mood strikes. Josh Bell was born in Terre Haute, or as we say in southern Indiana, Terrible Haute, and received his B.A. from Indiana State University, his M.A. from Southern Illinois University Carbondale, and his M.F.A. from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He is currently enrolled, or a Ph.D. candidate, at the University of Cincinnati. His poems have appeared in such magazines as Boston Review, The Colorado Review, Exquisite Corpse, Fence, Verse, and many other periodicals and publications. Please welcome fellow ex-Hoosier, fellow at Suwannee Writers Conference, my comrade in arms, socialist brawler, and beer and bourbon drinker on the front porch till 4 a.m. and then get up early in the goddamn morning for workshops, Josh Bell.
Now I'm nervous that y'all are looking at my big bosom. It's going to cut into my reading style. This is just a timer for me. Thank you, Richard Newman. Thanks for putting this on. I appreciate it. Thank you to Duff's, too, and the bartenders. Please tip them well. They're working hard for you. I'm going to start with a poem called The Last Critique. I don't know if any of y'all have ever been in a writing workshop before, but in 1999, when I graduated from the University of Iowa, I thought I was finished with them for good. And then the job market shrunk a little bit, and I had to go back again to workshops at the University of Cincinnati. I think last year I attended my last workshop, and this is my poem to the workshop. This is the kiss-off. It's called The Last Critique. We think Elizabeth's poems suck. We think Jason's poems suck, and we think Rachel's poems suck Elizabeth's poems. We didn't remember how or why the stranger's poems sucked, but we thought Holly was good, so it scared us when the stranger's poems refused to suck Holly's poems. A lot of people want to suck Fred's new poems, which suck, but they are too difficult for us to suck, and we'd rather suck his old ones, for though they are old and suck, it is much easier for us to suck them. When she reads them out loud, Clarice's poems suck pretty good, but we are reserving our final judgment until we've seen them sucking on the page. We think Martha's poems suck. Sometimes when we think we're sucking on one of Theodore's poems, we're actually sucking on two. We think Ed's poems have that Girl Scout look, which makes us want to start a family when we hear them through the keyhole sucking. Filbert's poems suck like they've been sucking Annie's poems too much. Annie's poems suck, but at least they brought something new to the act of sucking. We'd never seen a poem sucked like that before, and we thrilled to suck on them as if sucking on household appliances. Many people enjoy the austere sucking of Terry's poems. Still, no one pays to suck Terry's poems like they pay to suck Anton's. We think Tom Tom's poems suck so hard. We think Wendy's mature poems suck near the unassailable power of the stranger's poems. And at first we are always frightened, as if forced to suck an entire opera, when Wendy gets that Viking look and makes us suck her poems. Maybe we could pay Terry's poems, Wendy will say, to suck the stranger's poems. But the stranger's poems are missing, and Terry is afraid, and we do not blame him, as some of us recall the first time we heard the stranger's poems, which enter sucking bird and beast and flower, sucking queen and beggar, Oldsmobile and go-kart, saying long time no suck me, saying Terry, suck Wendy, suck Holly, saying suck me lonely mannequin, saying suck the abundant splendor and thrice gismatic suck of holy mannequin, saying suck theology, missile launch, stirrup and ballet. Some of us recall instead how the stranger's poems seem capable of sucking themselves, as if they no longer required us to suck them, and filled with terror, we had to run next door to suck our neighbor's poems real quick. But we all agree on the way when the stranger's poems end, they appear to suck the entire round planet all at once, the planet which, in the stranger's poems, unhinged jaws, comes dressed up like a bride and then a sailor, but all in the white of clouds and with a metallic S&M rig peeking through underneath, showing the chaste girdle of skyscrapers inside of which we suck and sleep and suck the poems we've written in fear of sucking the stranger's poems, which go on sucking hard for us through the disastered warp of time. The stranger's poems, uncanonized, built to be sucked in a way we will never understand, as the stranger's poems are a work of genius, and only our children's children will ever fully suck them. Thank you. I heard a little round of applause like back there. With me. Oh, thank you so much. Really, that's nothing. This is a short poem called Radishes. And I wanted to write a poem that had like a sort of a sonnet look to it. And the turn, like in the sonnet, you know, there's a turn eventually, would be man or wow. So I chose wow. Radishes. You'd look pretty good in that dress. You'd look good in a shower curtain. You wouldn't look so hot if you cut your own hair and wore the same overalls to the farmer's market every week. I don't like to see you at the farmer's market at all, in fact, holding up radishes and, as so often happens, tulip bulbs. You kind of look like everyone else looks. I get the same feeling when I see you in the yard. Wow, you could really be anyone out there, patching a bicycle tire, untangling the what have you from the neighbor's garden hose. I gotta remind myself when I'm reading. Once I got done with the first book, I decided that I wanted to try to write an epic poem. Don't get nervous, I'm not gonna read the whole thing all at once. And I talked to my friend Matt Gannett, who I usually sort of check in with when I get an idea, and he was like, yeah, we could write an epic poem. And I was like, we should write the first epic poem, like the two people have ever written, like, you know, a collaboration. And he was like, yeah, that sounds great. So we started writing these David Hasselhoff poems, where I would write a poem, and I would pick it because it was bad, and I would say, look, I don't know what's going on with this poem. I would send it to Matt, and Matt would write the footnotes to explain everything that you couldn't tell because the poem sucked so bad that you couldn't really. So we did that for a while, and he was like, look, David Hasselhoff knows that he's a fool. He's like sort of gets paid for his you know, pop culture status, so he's not a really good candidate. And he was like, what do you think about Vince Neil, the front man from Motley Crue, who has no sort of idea that he's a ridiculous personage? I was like, yes, that's perfect. So I wrote a poem and I sent it to Matt, and I was like, this is great, and Matt never sent me poems. I just happened to write them and sending them to Matt, and he never came back with it. So I started putting myself in the poems instead of Matt. So this is how the epic, the Vince Neil epic started. And they're smaller poems. They're going to sort of arc over the next book. This is Vince Neil meets Josh in a Chinese restaurant in Malibu after Ezra Pound. Back when my voice box was a cabinet full of golden vibrators, and my hair fell white across the middle of my back like a child's wedding dress, I made love to at least a dozen girls dressed up to look like me. The hotel bed, a sky filled with the spastic flock of our south flying mic scars. The back of my head and the front appearing simultaneously in hotel mirrors. And the twin crusts of our makeup sliding off into satin seas like bits of California coast. I heard my own lyrics coming out of the greasy tent of their beautiful wigs. My lyrics driven back towards me, pulled into me, demanding of me the willing completion of the vague circus acts I'd scribbled down once on the back of a golf card or on a piece of toilet paper. Sometimes I myself wonder what I was thinking then, but those words went on to live forever, didn't they? Radioed out into the giant Midwestern backseat and blasted into kneecaps and tailbones by that endless tongue of Berber carpeting, blanketing the American suburbs. Boys and girls strung like paper lanterns from here to Syracuse along my microphone cord. Who rocks you now, rocks you always, I told them all. And all of them somehow wearing a homemade version of the same leather pants I'd chosen to wear on stage that night. All of them hoping to enter me, to enter anyone, the way they thought I entered them. And the way I entered them was wishing I was somewhere else, or wishing I was the someone else who'd come along to enter me, which was the same thing. I am no fag, my new friend. Love in battle conditions requires a broad taxonomy. Queerness has its ever more visible degrees. Josh, I know you know what I'm talking about. You have the build of a stevedore. Which reminds me, more shrimp fried rice? As a child in Nanjing, I sculpted junks for my bread, and I slept in a hovel along the Changjiang River. In the cage there, I bred mice who built their nests from the frayed rope I'd taken from the decks. And one spring, when the babies did not emerge, I lifted up the rock that hid them, and I found they'd grown together, fused with each other in the tendrils of the nest. I held them up, 11 blind tomatoes wriggling on a blackened vine. My friends and I performed many surgeries. And now you come to me in this Chinese restaurant in Malibu, asking if you can help me. Please tell Circus Magazine, I love them forever. And please pass Pamela this message. If you get back to Malibu by springtime, drop by the boathouse, and I'll rock your ass as far as Chofu saw. Smattering of applause, thanks, but applause nonetheless. Y'all are familiar with books, I take it, since you showed up tonight and you read, apparently. You know, the back of the books, they have a note on the type, usually, that explains the history of the typeface and lets you know who invented that typeface and what it looks like, what are the typefaces it's similar to. I love those things because they're sort of inadvertently hilarious and kind of sort of a little pretentious, and though I feel for the typeset guy who really wants to write this thing to sort of validate his obsession with typeface, but still they're kind of ridiculous. And I read Phil Levine's note on the type. Phil Levine's a poet, and it was so funny that I had to try to write my own. So this is the note on the type from my book. It's called A Note on the Type. And it explains the typeface that's used throughout my book. An elegant, refreshing English linotype designed by the Red Nun of Prague, Sister Anna Maria Cornucopia, in the year 1456. This typeface was weaned on the Gutenberg Bible, beaten as a child, abandoned to earn a living on the mean streets of Barcelona, put in the stocks for coveting its neighbor's sheep and sleeping with anything, stoned by royalty, drunk by noon, excommunicated to Capri but shipwrecked on Ithaca, bred up Homeric, adopted by wolves, soon adolesced into apocalypse and petty exhibitionism, was card shark, known foot fetishist, having characteristics of the Balmer and Baskerville, but with a distinguished profile of its own, reminding one of the clouds that pass across the sun or a hearse pulling up to the drive-thru, was linked romantically to Vasco da Gama, had a good singing voice, poked John Milton with a spoon, denied involvement in several attempts on the life of the last remaining dodo, put dolphins to work, taught the facts of life to a Spaniard, offered up handkerchiefs when John Keats cried, once used to brand the words never again across an Antibian gigolo's backside, also available in paperback, was versatile member of parliament, known fencer, agent frauteur, tried its hand as cricket, was lost to history for 100 years before popping up as a trapper in Wisconsin, traveled widely, gave Emily Dickinson a piece of its mind, was 16th wife of the lost sheik of Memphis, Tennessee, 5th degree black belt, snappy dresser, bird dogger, roustabout, nanny rammer, jack roller, inventor of jelly, later shot Billy the Kid, moonlit as well digger, called in to smooth things over between Rimbaud and Verlaine, mispronounced French names, was shot in World War I and now has a funny looking F, broke up Scott Fitzgerald at parties, French-kissed Gertrude Stein, danced before Hitler, was dusted for the fingerprints of Jesus and St. Louis's own T.S. Eliot, burned books, ran for mayor, coined the phrase arid archipelago of loss, went down over Hanoi like a minister going down on his child bride, left the lid off the mayo, was credited with the writing of Virginia sodomy laws, moved to California where it picked up its tannic aftertaste and Joan Baez, changed its name to Slick, knocked out Mike Tyson in the first round, ran guns to Castro and Budweiser to Boy Scout Troop Number 9, fell on hard times, held up a convenience store in Fresno, white, 6 feet tall, Shakespeare's sonnet number 58 tattooed on the inside of its cheek, last used in ransom note asking $12 for the undismembered body of the reader and wanted so bad that we can taste it for the obscene and inarticulate trafficking of the moon. Remind yourself to drink water. This is another short poem. I think I can get it done in 30 seconds. It's called Milk Division. It's another little sonnet critter. Milk Division. I duct tape a border down the middle of every room. My side, your side. So I won't be able to watch the clock, and you won't be able to see the mirror while you dress each morning, and I'll have to lean across the plants to tell you what shoes you're wearing with what hat. It's a good system. If your toes wander onto my side of the bed, I'll keep them and raise them as my own, and one day you'll come home early and you'll catch me with your half of the milk. This is all in the future. God damn, you'll say. We should have tried this years ago. Let's see. I'm going to read a Ramona poem, although I'm trying to decide now which one I'm going to read. I've got a big poem in the center of the book called Epithalamian Ex Post Facto. Epithalamian is a wedding song, as you all probably know. And this figure, Ramona, runs through the whole book, of course, and Richard had just recently quoted a little bit for you from one of the poems. And, you know, I got to writing these poems, and sooner or later she took them over from me, and I would start writing a poem, and I wouldn't know where it was going, and I would understand that this was actually a Ramona poem, and I'd throw it in that group, and that kept happening, and I was like, look, this is, I got to write something else, and so how am I going to get rid of her, this character that's in this book? And so I decided, first of all, to try to marry her off to someone else, and that's what this poem comes in, Epithalamian Ex Post Facto, where I attempt to marry this, you know, person over to someone else, I don't have to write about her anymore. And then, like, after this, that doesn't take. And after this, I wrote a poem where I just try to kill her then to get rid of her. And then after that, like, once I killed her off, I was like, well, I kind of miss her. So now I wrote a poem at the end of the book where I build a sort of a cyborg that looks like her at the end of the book. So she comes back at the end. So that's kind of the scope of the book. Those poems are scattered through it. This is the one where I try to marry her off. And so I'm going to read you the first section and the third section out of this. The rhymes in the third section are going to sound a little funny. But in the second section, I kind of build up to them, hoping that I don't make them so funny, but you're just going to see the first and the third, so. This is Epithalamian Ex Post Facto. And by this time, he's had it up to here with her. Section 1. Ramona, you went ahead and married the tannest Christian bank machine in Illinois. For 30 years, his infant lips have cycled toward you like an escalator across his tiled face. Where was my invitation? What poem was I writing? Every bride is gartered for a reason. Every bride is a lonesome holocaust, contains secret prophecies she whispers only to the buffet table. When I heard you arc the bouquet a little high and it went to sudden potpourri in the ceiling fan of the Lincoln Ballroom, Holiday Inn, Riverside Drive, I remembered that I've always been a sucker for the thought of you, tiered and bridal, coiffed by nymphs and right with God. But now you're belted supine in Nassau, your honeymoon an acheless continuation of motions you began before I met you, when I met you in the forest, before the thing called time. Your future bridegroom was only kindling then, a glimmer in your eye, and I was yet an epic from the thought of you together, spread out like maps on the bathroom tile, your incandescent wedding dress an afterthought flung into the harbor and riding back to the beaches like a poisoned white tide. Swim at your own risk, Ramona. Whoever marries now will long stay so. Whoever reaches out with empty hand. 3. If this were Chinese time, you'd be divorced by now. You've punished all the powdered nymphs who plagiarized your vows, and I must infect myself with wedding toasts alone. Pick up the flowers and the phone, Ramona. Drunk, I look wonderful. I smell good, too. I don't know French, and I know less you. If torn to rags, your wedding dress could bandage a platoon. You recline like a piano. You strike me like the moon strikes up the tide. I will invent a little wedding dance based on the Charleston, the defibrillator, and on the second chance. So let the bride feel as if she's just been born. Let the band play songs only heard in pornographic movies. For I have left instructions for the groom in the corner stall. I am the mitochondria boating through the bride's cell walls, many indivisible, clowning like drowned men, my thousand teeth slick with kindness and disease. Let the uninvited wedding guest bite the bride's white knees. Let the bride toss her bouquet into the ballroom ceiling fan. Let the bridegroom cry over the body of his best man, and let the wonky bridesmaids sing. If you drop a quarter in the nearest priest, you get another wedding ring. Like Brian Taylor, people are always like to me, you know, why don't you write, you know, autobiographical poems, all these weird poems that you write all the time, crazy things going on that couldn't possibly happen in real life. So, you know, I'm like, okay, I'll write a poem for you. It's called Sleeping with Julia Roberts. This shit is all true. And I call her Alice at one point because in The Pelican Brief, which movie if you've ever seen, she goes into hiding and her little code name is Alice. She smelled like plastic fruit, and Pablo Neruda was her favorite poet. Her thoughts, stoked with speed and Nietzsche and wired by Paramount, brought out the secret patterns of the bedroom wallpaper, shuddering valences of time, blue daisies, a frozen horse against which I spread my legs and read myself my rights. She was crazy about pasta salad. She never called me Ace. She never lied. It sounded like bourgeois when she sneezed. And each time she came into a room where I already was, she'd click her tongue and snap, "You're not supposed to be in this picture, boy." But it was me who bought the custom-made dental pick she wore around her neck on a silver chain. It was me who tilted back that giant head and worked the plaque until she screamed. I engraved messages for archaeologists below the gum line. I frosted up the hot, chalky remains of a battleship lost against the icy flows of her crenellated teeth. Once it was her birthday. She swallowed the room. The room slipped into her mouth backwards, like a car wheeled into a garage. And I realized then that love had evolved, and no longer should I be concerned with God, who tossed his dice across her stomach, who bet her museum-quality bones against his own, then timed her record quarter mile. And when he felt her hit his holy bloodstream like a B-grade nightingale, it was the death of man. On bad nights, I'd find her adding freakish columns of numbers on the bathroom tile, shivering, barefoot, shit-faced on the scowl, her moon in Virgo, her father's rusty six-hole leather punch, a souvenir bulge in the front pocket of her unzipped purple jeans. Alice, I'd say. She made me call her Alice. Alice, come back to bed. The worst is over now. Your pink knitting lung is a perfect fit tonight, and I can already feel your prescription dry tongue popping like a match down my spine. This always worked. Her scars turned into wine. I prayed our babies would have her beautiful, beautiful round head, the flotsam eyes, her webbed tongue coiled on each drawbridge mouth, and on each tongue her god-awful name. I was in love with her when she was played by time. No one else can say the same. And last poem is a Vince Neil poem. I'm going to come back to him here. This is one where he accompanies me to a luncheon with scholars, poets, and others, and he gets a cell phone number of a great... This is the title, sorry, let me start over here. Vince Neil accompanies Josh to luncheon with scholars, poets, and others, gets cell phone number of grad students sitting at far end of table, orders cheeseburger, no tomato, borrows Josh's cell phone, calls grad students sitting at far end of table. And, I just started taking to the idea of like bringing Vince Neil along with me to all these sort of stiff functions that you have to go to if you're a poet, and sort of thinking to myself out loud, what would Vince Neil do in this situation? If I'd been born a girl, like you, I wouldn't have lived any longer than I will. And whether I'd be waiting in my new long johns or in the plus-sized version of your blouse and Target pumps, still the ancient Boy Scout death would sidle up and find me in the boathouse, compliment my penmanship, my knots, and then he'd lead me to the minivan, never to be seen with this hairstyle again, the handsome scalp and blonde fringe now worn by seagulls who hit the high notes like it was nothing, who think in unison, though they never seem to fly that way, instead go dropping singular from the squiggled flock after bread crust and fish eye, blip, blip, down from the sky, robe threads of EKG. I mean to say what's globbed is globbed for good, and even John Keats will not unfuck it for us. But maybe you have this feeling about me. Good. And maybe then you paste that feeling down with words, and I do the same. And then dreaming in our beds, we get the lonely message from each other, just in time, just as the jackbooted soldiers come rushing in, over the picket fence, with every fourth beat of the fearful heart gun pulsing out its tracer bullet into a pothole DMZ of sky. I'm not sure what your dreams are like. The moon now a cross-section of bludgeoned tomato over the schoolhouse, and now a white pants button lost on the highway asphalt. Learning is strictly for girls. The gun's still going chop, chop, chop. And John Keats, in those remaining years, he kept sending up his test obituaries, like weather balloons, poems still floating even now over Tulsa and the like, the comely bivalve pentameter interfering with radio signals, just the reverse of the way a beautiful living body can scan so vibrantly it zones out all the ghost code, can get between me and the important messages I should be getting from the underworld. One code for another, the dead only interfering with the living who've interfered with the dead. And along those lines, I really think I'd be suspicious of that veggie plate if I was you. It's strange how rarely the meat they serve us resembles an animal. And strange how the vegetables, despite their cleanliness and grace, so often do. A tail or torso of zucchini. And once I saw a rat-shaped eggplant hunched feral in a kitchen off Hermosa. Look to the sea, as always, for echoes. Of course, the many benthic cousins of the turnip. Spindly fruits morphing up their bodies for our inspection in unsounded caves filled with various see-through creatures easily mistaken for prostitutes. And finally, the sirens plugging up their ears against what new songs we have to offer. My latest begins with a simple verse about the girl with one lung and one gill, how she loved me, how she sang, and how I never kissed her more than 20 feet away from a swimming pool. How she answered the phone and how her phone voice made me feel like running away to the forest, rebuilding the old treehouse, then interrogating the lilies of the field. And I promise you, whatever your name is, I'm going to ride this feeling all the way to Target, because eventually all voices cease, and if I've been reading these poems right, there's a hand job waiting for us in the clouds. Thanks.